Good morning. My name is Steve Gamare. I was born in San Francisco in 1968, and I grew up in Fairbanks, Alaska. My mom was a hippie, and she went to Alaska to get back to nature, not knowing that part of the year is 50 below zero there. And I grew up in Fairbanks. Then I moved to Thailand when I was 18, and on my way to Thailand, I stopped in Japan to teach English for a little while, and that's where I met my Norwegian wife. Then I lived in Thailand. I meant to live there for a year, but in fact, I stayed for 23 years. And then in 1998, when my three daughters, who were all born in Thailand, my oldest was starting high school, we moved to where my wife grew up in Norway. In 2009, which is where I live today. All along, since I moved to Thailand, roughly for 30 years, my wife and I have been working with refugees. And these 30 years, we've led a team called Partners Relief and Development, which your church has been a part of by way of contributions, supporting this work, helping families running from war. Last year, in May, my wife and I started Novi. We resigned from our other organization to get back to having some fun again, more focused on the needs of children, specifically, who are living in a state of war or active conflict. So I told you I have three daughters. One of them is named Kristen. She's my youngest. When we moved to Norway, she had never kicked a soccer ball. And when she got to Norway, she thought it could be really fun to join the girls' soccer team. And so she did. And she was very good on that team that first season, to the point where she was like the star player. And in the next season, she developed a reputation because she was so good that the other girls were afraid of her. I have many videos taken by my phone of Kristen dribbling through the entire field and doing a corner shot into the goal, and the crowd erupting with applause for my little star. Do you have kids? And so Kristen just kept playing. Within three seasons, she was promoted to the boys' team because she was so good that she couldn't stay in this on the girls' team. And so she quickly became the second best player on that team, on the boys' team. And then after that, she got recruited to be a part of Norway's talent in soccer. She was recruited to play in league and start division play. And she worked her way up through the divisions to where now she's a professional soccer player playing first division in Oslo in Norway. Of course, I'm bragging, but I'm also talking about a child that I would do anything for. Of course, all three of my children have these brilliant angles where I can find myself lost in love, wanting to show them how much I care as a father for them. I would do anything for my daughters. I would do anything for Kristen. Because the thief in our life, the thief in society, the thief in the world, comes only to steal, kill, and destroy. That's what Jesus said in John 10:9, right? And in 10:10, he said that. He came that we being, not just we who sit here today, but Kristen on the soccer pitch, and these Yazidi people in Iraq, and all of these ethnic states at war in Myanmar, he came that this entire planet might have abundant life. Now I'm going to come back to Kristen, and I'd like to move on to Karen. And all of this is going to tie into this very challenging passage of scripture that we heard read. Karen was a 10-year-old girl living in Frankfurt. She was in grade school, and one of her teachers, Mr. Something or another, organized a parade to celebrate Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich. So Karen, this 10-year-old little girl, carried a swastika flag and walked in this parade with her class. Karen's father was Jewish, But the family didn't identify with being Jewish for a number of reasons. One is they were faithful Lutherans, and they thought that that kind of gave them a shield from the Jewish story. And they were good citizens. Her father was an engineer with General Electric, or AEG as it's called in Europe. And he was married to a Spanish woman, which he thought also gave him some protection from the Third Reich. And so imagine looking back in time at this 10-year-old daughter carrying a swastika, marching in support of Adolf Hitler down the street, not really even understanding that she herself was Jewish and that she was in danger. Well, if you remember, or if you're a history buff, that the government building in Frankfurt was burned down, the Reichstag fire. And in this event, media blamed the Jewish people for that fire. They accused them of arson. And so Karen's father, on the bus to work just after this fire, was overheard to be complaining about media's handling of it and how this couldn't be something that Jewish people would plan and do. It didn't make any sense to him. He got to work that day and was met by some intelligence officers who interviewed him or interrogated him for some hours, and then he was relieved of his job as an engineer. He was fired, and he went home. And when he went home, he realized that what he thought would protect him from the scrutiny of the Nazis and the Third Reich wasn't a protection any longer. They were on to him. He was on their list, and now he's understood to be an agitator. And so he packed his family up, pulled Karen and Karen's two siblings, packed their suitcases, and moved to Spain. And again, they thought they would be okay there, but what happened in Spain right after Hitler happened to Germany? So Franco negotiated a deal. Franco was also a fascist and a terrible strongman, and he negotiated a deal with Hitler for a railway to be built to take all of the Jews and undesirables to Auschwitz for slave labor or to be in the death camp across the street. And so before that train was operating, he again packed his bags and went overland through Germany, in fact, to Italy, which was the last country to fall to Hitler in the war in continental Europe. And what happened in Italy then? Somebody said Mussolini happened to Italy, and that's exactly what happened. And Mussolini agreed to a deal where a railway would be built to take all the undesirables and the Jews north to Auschwitz for the same destiny, the same awful destiny. And so Karen's father negotiated a visa. Did you know that China was giving visas to Jewish people during the war? He got a visa to go, I think it was to Beijing. And then because of the visa, he could buy a ticket on a steamship, and I still have a copy of that ticket. Steamship ticket, it says on the top. And then it's the list of all the family members. Karen's family. And so just before the train started operating and taking the Jews north to Germany, they ended up on a boat. While Karen's family was in Spain, there were some good Samaritans at General Electric who were feeding work to Karen's father. They did this so that he would have some livelihood and could provide for his family. But they also did this at great personal risk, because if they were known to be assisting a Jewish person or a Jewish family, their lives were at risk, their families were at risk of violence. Right? So some good Samaritans were there in General Electric helping this family as they fled. And as they fled again from Spain down to Italy, remember I said they had to go through Germany? In Germany, two families helped them, gave them a place to stay overnight, and helped them along their way get through Germany and down to Italy. Again, good Samaritans who risked their lives to do what was morally important. It was an imperative in their mind. And they asked not, this is Martin Luther King Jr. when he talks about the parable of the Good Samaritan. He says that the Samaritan, when he came, he asked a different question than the Levite and the priest. The Levite and the priest said, what will happen to me if I help this man? Because it would be required that they go through purification ceremonies, because handling a dead person required that, and all kinds of other cultural issues, right? But the Good Samaritan, on his donkey, said, what will happen to him? It's a fundamental change in perspective. The Good Samaritan helps us understand how we relate to the world that we live in. It's not what's going to happen to us. It's not what is the risk involved and why shouldn't we do this right thing. It's not how much is this going to cost and can we pull this off. Those aren't the primary questions. And yet they're the first questions I ask often. The primary question that Jesus is pointing to when he's asked a very important question. Now remember, this is one of two times that Jesus was asked, how do I go to heaven? So his answer is pretty important. And his answer is this. These Germans, they were good Samaritans. They didn't ask, what will happen to me if I do this thing? That wasn't their primary question. They asked, what will happen to this poor family if they're caught? They're dead. And they did the right thing. They did what the lawyer answered when Jesus said, what's your reading of the law? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. And so they're on this steamship headed to China, and they docked in Madras, India. And the Allied forces and the British, they were always looking for reasons to give visas and help people fleeing the conflict. They knew what was happening. When this ship docked in Madras, the offer of a visa was given for someone to be an au pair, a child caregiver for a Royal Air Force family. And somehow it was decided that Karen, now 13 years old, would accept that visa and work for that family. So she was separated from her family. Her family went on to China and she stayed in Madras through the war. When the war got over, she was taken to a camp where prisoners of war were kept, because all of these Jews and undesirables who fled, guess which passport they held? You know, they had a German passport. And so they were incarcerated after the war. But again, the Allied forces knew these are the good guys. And so they made their incarceration into a kind of party where 13 and 14 and 15-year-old Karen said she had the time of her life. Karen had her first boyfriend in that camp, got her first kiss, and learned how to dance in Delhi, India. After the war was over, the family was somehow reunited in England and they moved to Brighton. In Brighton, Karen fell in love with a guy named Ronald, a British guy. They got together, they got married, and then they had their first son. His name was Peter. And then right after they had their first son, they immigrated to California, San Francisco. New to the free world, having survived the Holocaust, 16 of their immediate relatives weren't so fortunate. They were killed in the camps or otherwise disappeared through the violence of World War II. Peter grew up in San Francisco and had a girlfriend named Lynn, and on one of their adventures, Lynn got pregnant, and Lynn was 18. And when Lynn's father found out, they were living in Mill Valley, California. When Lynn's father found out, he said, you're either going to get married or you're going to have an abortion. There's no honor in this story. And so Lynn and Pete decided to get married. And then some months later, they had a little baby boy, Peter and Lynn. And that little baby boy was me, Stephen Ronald Gamera. I tell you the story because if it weren't for these good Samaritans in Germany, I wouldn't be standing here before you today. Very unlikely. Good Samaritans mean a lot to me. And in my study of Scripture, when I look at what the white-hot core of faith is, when I look at verses like the Good Samaritan parable, I understand that what everything boils down to is what we do with our faith. Right? Otherwise, our words are meaningless. They're gongs, Paul says. Clanging cymbals. They're noise. We talk about Jesus and our love for Jesus with flowery terms. And we invite people to become a part of our community of faith with words. But if our words don't correspond with actions, what do we have? Well, John in 1 John 3:18 says, that's loving with just word and tongue, but rather than that, we should lay down our lives for the brethren and love in word and deeds. He says we should keep our heart open to the poor and not shut our heart out against them. So the white-hot core of our faith, the thing that we all have in common here is our attraction to love, right? And it is love embodied and acted on that the world understands that Jesus is alive. And that story was very personal for me because Karen was my grandmother. And it was my great-grandfather who was fired for being a Jew. And if not for these people who acted on a higher impulse, on a higher value of love, then I wouldn't have been born in San Francisco. And they wouldn't have survived the Holocaust. And it's the same call that we all have today. We're all called to be good Samaritans. The answer to the question, how do we go to heaven, is answered very clearly in Luke chapter 10. We love God with our whole heart, soul, mind, and strength. And we love our neighbor as ourself. And who is our neighbor? That's the whole point of the parable. Is Kristen, my daughter, my neighbor? Are you my neighbors? Is everyone in this state my neighbor? Is everyone in this country, in the world, and even as Jesus used the hero in the story was the enemy of the Jews, you know, the Samaritans. There was such strong racism between these two groups that a Jew had to go through a purification ceremony if a Samaritan spit in conversation, if the spit of a Samaritan landed on your person, they had to be purified. And now the Samaritan is the hero of the story. Everybody in the whole world is our neighbor. And we are called to care. We are called to understand love and have love fill us to the point that it's overflowing like it did with Jesus. And to be this magnetic force that draws people into what? Love. That love may be balm on a hurting heart, may help the single mother that really needs more than words, but she needs groceries and a babysitter this next week. It may be life-saving medical care that we give to someone because we see their need and we have what? What did the Samaritan have? The one who showed mercy, right? Love is an unstoppable force that may save lives. So, with that as the background, with the Good Samaritan in mind, I'd like to invite my colleague. We work together in an organization we named Novi. Novi is a Latin adjective, and it means new. That's all it means, new. And I'd like to ask him to come up and tell you a little bit about what we're all about. And he was just in Ukraine on the front line for 3 weeks. So what you'll hear now is very fresh. So John, can you come on up? Thanks.
Good morning. So you're probably wondering, who is this guy and how old is he? I'm John, I'm 26 years old, and I come from a little town in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I come from the generation who knows what pagers are, but have never really been paged myself. Grand Rapids might be familiar to some of you because it's nearby to Holland, Michigan, which is the birthplace, I believe, of this denomination, CRC. As Steve mentioned, I just returned from the front lines of Ukraine. We visited about 15 villages that were within about 2 miles of where the fighting is. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about what that was like. Something I didn't understand going into this journey was the scale of what the front line looked like. If you can imagine the coast of California, the Pacific coast of California, actually I met some lovely folks who are from there earlier today. That coast is about 800 miles long. The front line is about 630 miles long. So if you can imagine the entire coast of California at war, and if you're within 5 miles of the coast, then your town or little village or big city is under attack 24 hours a day. We visited these villages around 11 a.m. or around noon because that's the safest time to be there. But even as we were there working with groups of children, we could hear explosions in the distance. And that was very surreal for me, to be working with kids in a place where explosions happen all the time. And I would just go back to my hotel, which was in Zaporizhia. You may have heard of Zaporizhia. That's where the nuclear power plant is. So if you've been watching the news, that was one of the cities that we visited. And I would go back to my hotel and I would weep because of the things that these kids are experiencing in this war. So something else I didn't understand is how the war is happening right now. I had this impression that the violence had slowed down, it was sort of a stalemate, nobody was really gaining or losing ground. And while that may be true, the violence hasn't slowed down. During the Cold War, the Soviets stockpiled artillery for a war with the West that never came. And so all day, every day, they have a nearly unlimited supply of artillery, which has about a 5-mile range. And so that's why these villages in particular are under attack. If you visit one of these villages, you'll find that about 60% of the buildings have been reduced to rubble. You might see a wall standing, but there's no roof, there's no windows. And the other 40% are severely damaged. If you'll show the first photo, this is just an example of one of the buildings, and that's a melted school bus. This was a school that was bombed a week before we arrived. And the pastor who brought us there was very nervous to stay in that area. He wanted to leave very quickly because the Russians don't know that they hit this school, and so they still try to hit it almost every day. So if you're in that area, it's quite dangerous. If you're a child living in this area, there is no bomb shelter, there is no cellar. Well, they do have cellars, but there's no warning. Because the front line is so close, the flight time for missiles and artillery, there would be no point. You'd be hiding all day long. And so what do? They do what any of us would do, which is they continue their lives. They plant their gardens, they tend to their cows, they tend to their goats, and they hope that it's not them today. I'm gonna pass this around. So you might have to move around in your seat a little bit. This is a piece of a Russian missile. And what happened is the pastor who brought us to his church said that for 7 years they had been saving up to build this humble little church. And about a month after it was finished, it was hit by this missile. The pastor, he dug it out of the wall and gave it to me so that I could show people. One of the other things I didn't understand was the size of the cities along the front line. For instance, Zaporizhia. Zaporizhia has a population of 1.1 million people, which, if Google doesn't fail me, Seattle is about 700 or 800,000. So if you can picture a city much bigger than Seattle, people are still riding the bus, people are still going to restaurants, people are still living their lives, working their jobs just like we would. And then they go to bed at night, and because they're within 50 miles, they're within range of the rockets, which are about 6 feet long. These are bigger than the artillery, which have a 5-mile range. They're about 6 feet long, and they have a 50-mile range, and those are what fly into Zaporizhia every night. And so I'm laying in my bed, it's 2 in the morning, and I just hear the loudest explosion I've ever heard in my life, right outside my window, is what it felt like to me. So I went to the window to see the giant fireball. It turns out it was so far away I couldn't even see it. But the noise and the shaking of the window, it really rattled me. I hid under my bed because what was going through my mind is, if this window breaks and the glass gets shot into my room, I could be maimed, I could be killed. These are very practical thoughts that are going through my head, and I'm hiding under my bed and I'm afraid. And one of the other things I think is, this is what these people are living with all day, every day, for over a year. And I was really surprised by that. And I was really amazed by the strength of these people. But what broke my heart was what the children are going through. When a child is under stress, or really when any of us are under stress, and I'm learning all of this psychology from our psychologists that we work with, when we're under stress, we go into either fight or flight, which is the active state of stress, or we go into freeze. That's hiding, becoming invisible, hiding from a wild animal, let's say, but in this case, hiding from explosions. And that's the state that I met most of the children that we worked with, is this sort of shutdown state. And so the thing that we're doing there is distributing and educating people about the human stress response. Because when we go to these villages, the first question we ask is, what do you need? This is an ethical thing. We want to know what they need. We don't want to just come in and say, you need this and you need that and we know best for you. We want to ask them what they need. And the thing that I was really surprised to hear is, we need help with our kids. This is what everybody said. We feel like we lost them. We know they're hurting, but we don't know what to do about it. Because when a child is frozen and shut down, they can't speak, and they don't have access to decision making. And so some of these children, when you meet them, they can't even tell you their name because they're in that stressed out state. So what is this? This is a game. It's a backpack filled with 15 very simple items. It includes a twister mat. We're going to play this later. You guys know this game. And it also includes some dice. It includes a beach ball, a jump rope, a sketch pad, and many other items. Also, an instruction book written in Ukrainian. And in that instruction book are 260 activities specifically designed by psychologists to help regulate a child's emotional state so that they can regulate from this frozen, shut-down, nonverbal state into what psychologists call the window of tolerance, which is likely where we all are today, unless you're very stressed out that you left the stove on or something like that. So as we visited these villages, we worked with groups of about 15 to 20 children, and it was really profound to be able to see the science behind this tool work. Because when we started our work, the children were nonverbal, they're unable to speak, and they feel very alien. They feel like they're uncomfortable in their own bodies. But after we get them moving, after we get them breathing, after we get them doing these activities, they come to life. They're kids again. They haven't changed. They're still there on the inside. They're just stressed out. If you wouldn't mind, Beth, could we see the next photo? Thank you. So this was a group that lived in a city called Ukrainsk. And in this village, some of these children lost their home about a month ago to a mortar. I think it was the two on the right. And they were in their cellar hiding because the attacks were especially heavy that day. And their home was hit by a mortar and they lost everything. And now they're living with their grandmother, or babusa in Ukrainian, in their barn, being heated by a potbelly stove. When I first met them, they couldn't tell me their names. After 45 minutes or an hour, they're like this. They're no different than the children that I work with here in the States. If you'll show the next picture, Beth. These are some of the babusas I mentioned. In fact, the lady in the blue is the lady who is living in her barn with her grandchildren. It's really precious to see these people come alive, and I'm really grateful to be a part of this work. One of the things we asked is, what message do you want to send back with me to the States, to the people who are supporting this work, who are attempting to be Good Samaritans and attempting to ease some of the suffering that these people are experiencing? And without exception, they wanted to say thank you. So I'm here to say thank you. Thank you for hearing their stories. Thank you for praying. And for those of you who decide to contribute to our work, thank you for that. Steve, I think Steve has a few more words for us.
back to Kristen, my spectacularly talented and beautiful daughter. I told you that story because, well, for one reason, a lot of us here today have a Kristen in our lives. We have children and grandchildren, and it's something we can all identify with. And when I think about Kristen, I think there is no limit to what I would do to help her. And what I feel about the kids in Ukraine is that they're not distant anymore. They're not news to me. They're not statistics. They're not something I read in the paper or see on TV. They're a bunch of Christians. They're beautiful little kids who were unfortunate because of where they were born. Unfortunate because of the time of war that they were born in, and living in this constant state of war, needing food, needing shelter, needing basic supplies, needing the restoration of broken community, and needing support for their emotional and mental health. It was what the parents all had to say. Please help us, we've lost our kids. That's what they say. When they don't have any food, they say that. That's what's really interesting to me. I wonder what I would say in their situation. But I also identify with this value. Our kids are the future. And if anything needs help, if anyone needs support, it's our kids. This is what they cry for. This is what they want and need. And as soon as they understand a way, they have this kit. We've just given out 500 of these kits in the last month, and our goal is to give out 500 a month for the next year. When they see the kit and they understand that their child in a state of crisis with bombs coming down and maybe in a basement hiding from the threat of violence every night, that their kids misbehaving or being disrespectful because they're quiet, those children don't really even understand what's happening themselves. And they pull this kid out and start regulating back to a calm state. And again, within minutes, our kids are back. And what this kit does, as do all of the tools that we're using in Ukraine with children right now, what it does is it trains them to self-regulate. They think they're just playing a game, but what they're learning to do is breathe out their stress. In this activated state, they're shallow breathing. They're not getting enough oxygen in their brain. So they jump rope. Deep breathing. It corrects it immediately. Using your major muscle groups, we've learned from these psychologists that we're working with, releases dopamine and endorphins, which combats the cortisol and adrenaline that's being dripped into their system day in and day out. It brings them, it buoys them into a calm state. Concentrating. Do you guys jump rope? I mean, it's been a little while for me, but when you jump rope, especially if you change directions or you want to do double skips, two to one hop, it takes concentration, right? So your mind is also being trained away from the anxiety that we feel because there's a threat and into a calm state where kids can be kids, even in a war zone. So that's the work that Novi does, and we have committed to. There's 450 million children living in war zones today. There's 27 active wars in the world. And children who suffer this dysregulated state, children who end up with sleep disorders and clinical depression and become suicide cases or other pathological states, that's all preventable, even here in Mount Vernon and in the cities that that belong to this great country we're all a part of. And so we go there with this kit. But what do we go there with? What motivates us? What gives us the energy to do this for 30 years? It's really this guy named Jesus. He promised abundant life to we who walk in his footsteps, and he has shown us that when we do that, we are a magnetic force, an attractive force of love, and we change the world around us. That's what we're called to do here this morning. It's why we gather, and it's what we're called to do in our city, in our country, and in the world. And I know so many of you are doing these Good Samaritan acts. I know it. Every church I go to, I know it for a fact. And it's beautiful. It's how our community, it's how our world understands and sees that Jesus is alive. He sees it through us. If, in addition to the things you're doing, you'd like to join our team at the Novi community, somehow, prayerfully, or with your support, you can reach those kids on the other side of the world. And if that interests you, we've got these sheets that are in the fellowship hall, I hope you call it. And there's a space for your name and email address. If you fill that out and rip off this piece of paper, John will put it in our computer and send you an email with basic information. And he can also put you on a list where once a month you can be brought up to date on how we're working to be good Samaritans in the war zone of Ukraine, and how our eyes are focused with laser intention on how we can help children get through this war, be healthy, be equipped to make better decisions so that war is not a perpetual state but can be changed in a generation or maybe even within 15 years, because these little guys and girls, they're just about to make decisions to change our lives, right? So I invite you to join us. These are in the fellowship hall. And I want to leave you again with the Good Samaritan. Who is my neighbor? It's not what the Pharisees said. It's not just the people who we share a wall with. It's not what the Sadducees said. It's not just people in our tribe or our bubble, our faith bubble. Nope. Who is the Good Samaritan? Who is the hero of the story who Jesus says goes to heaven? It's the one who showed mercy. And that's what we do. So show mercy and love. Be filled with the love we all share together today. And I'm grateful to be a part of this community. And as we travel together, you're a part of ours. So thank you and God bless you, Pastor.